Presentation of A Novel Idea on KRCB is made possible by our members and by SolarWorks, reminding you that SolarWorks offers public going solar workshops to answer all your questions about solar electricity. More information at solarworksca.com.
But I told you I don't want to go.
But you have an engagement, and I don't want people to talk.
Talk? About me? About us?
Precisely.
Afraid I'm ruining your reputation, Monsieur Laval?
No, yours, madame.
Monsieur Laval, I have a confession to make to you. You like me. In fact, you're crazy about me. Otherwise, you wouldn't think about my reputation. Isn't that so? But incidentally, I don't like you. I don't like you at all. And I wouldn't hesitate one instant to ruin your reputation. Like that.
You wouldn't?
No, I wouldn't.
Like that?
Like that.
I know all your tricks.
And you're going to fall for them.
So you think you can get me?
Any minute I want.
You're conceited.
But attractive.
Now let me
shut tell up. You. Kiss me.
You've been listening to a clip from a movie called Trouble in Paradise from 1932. And the players in it are Miriam Hopkins, Kay Francis, and Herbert Marshall. And we're going to be talking tonight about movies. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. Good evening. I'm glad you are joining us for our trip to Hollywood. Hollywood in the glamour days. With Warner Brothers and Cecil B. DeMille, Betty Davis, Carol Lombard, William Powell, the Marx Brothers, and Kay Francis. Remember her? Sort of. A stunning brunette. Beautiful clothes. Well, we ought to remember her. She made 86 films. She was Walter Winchell's favorite artist. And there's a new book out about her called Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten. And the author of that book is here in the studio, Scott O'Brien. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, I am too. I found the book fascinating, not only because Kay Francis is so interesting, but because it seemed to me a history of American film from the 30s almost to the present, and maybe even a history of America, because it seemed to reflect so much that was going on in society at that time.
I felt that, too, when I was doing the research. I had to really stretch and learn to understand her and appreciate her and take a second look at our culture at the same time.
That's right. Your research is fabulous.
Well, thank you.
I was so impressed. And for people who want to know the details of her films, it's all in your book because of the footnotes and the notes in the back, and then a complete list, not only of her movies and her shorts, but her radio work and her television work. So for people who really want to know about films of the 30s, this is your book.
I also included brief synopsis of her films terms of how it related to her role. It was a tribute to her career.
Yes.
For years, I hadn't seen any of these films. I'd read about them, and I'd be really frustrated because I wanted to see the film. Mm-hmm. And they're still not really available unless you watch Turner Classic Movies. So that's part of the book, is that you get to visualize her role and the film itself.
Yeah, I discovered that not many of her films are available through the usual channels, but the ones that are certainly worth having a look at. It takes you back to what movies were like in those days.
Right, and there's a real contrast between her early work before 1934 and what preceded it.
I noticed that, and we're going to talk about that, mm-hmm. the whole arc of her career. But I have to ask you, first of all, why Kay Francis, what led you to choose her to be the subject of your research in your book?
Well, really, the film critic Mick LaSalle, he works for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's responsible. I had written an article on Kay for Films of the Golden Age in 1996, and I had contacted LaSalle because he was working on a book on pre-code Hollywood. And I asked him if he was going to pay tribute to Kay Francis, and he said, I need her films. What do you have? So I met him for lunch, and I took along these films that he had requested. And afterward, after our meeting, I said, you know, after this pre-code book, you need to do a book on Kay Francis. And he said, no, Scott, you need to do one.
Excellent.
So it was a few years later, January 2003, that right after New Year's, I sat down, and I just had this feeling like, I'm going to write her story.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, because the other stars of that era, their names seem to be more familiar today than the name of Kay Francis. And you're helping to bring her back into the spotlight.
Right. Kay was the highest paid woman in Hollywood in 1937. In 1937 also, she and Errol Flynn were the only stars at Warner Brothers that made the top box office. And it's amazing how her star had plummeted. And my publisher, like he, Ben Omart from Bear Manor Press, he said, who needs another book on Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn? There, we need to pay tribute to these forgotten stars who were so popular and did affect our culture.
And you found out so much about her. She was Walter Winchell's favorite artist.
Right.
That's many people listening will know who Walter Winchell was, and others can look him up. But the title of the book, Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to be Forgotten.
Well, Kay had a way with words, and she was battling Warner Brothers. She had been promised this sophisticated part in a play called Tovarich, and it had been a big hit on Broadway. And she wanted something to equal her role in Trouble in Paradise, which we just heard a little excerpt from.
Yes.
And Warner Brothers handed it to Claudette Colbert. So she took Warner's to court. And in the aftermath, she became very bitter. Warner Brothers, she bought out her contract. And her last interview on the Warner lot in the fall of 1938... she was being interviewed by Dick Mook, who was a popular columnist at the time, and she started it out by saying, I can't wait to be forgotten. And I thought, that's perfect for a title.
It is. It's a perfect title because it just brings the writer in, and you want to know what was behind her thinking.
And inevitably, this struggle, she always referred to it as her struggle in her retirement years, afforded her the opportunity to completely redefine herself.
Yes.
And let go of being a star and being of service. She got involved with the Red Cross and was a mover and shaker at the Naval Aid Auxiliary Hospital in Corona. She spent many hours with a dying man until he crossed over.
Yes.
This is during the war, World War II.
Yes.
And she, Martha Ray, Carol Landis were the first women to go to into the battle zones in Algeria.
That's a great part of the book. Four Jills in a Jeep.
Right.
Yes. That what a great
and that is
story.
Out on DVD. I think in August it's coming out.
Oh, excellent. Mm-hmm. So we can actually see that. Now, there was one version of that she didn't care for that was overproduced. And
she didn't care for the film at all.
Oh, and this
she,
is the
she
film.
She thought it, yeah, this is the film. Okay. So she thought it really, it didn't quite capture the integrity and the challenge of the work that they did over there.
Yes.
And Warner Brothers at the time, it was actually Fox. This was out of Fox.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Fox was into musicals. So they made a big musical extravaganza, which it wasn't.
Of course not. They were on the battlefields. They were very close to combat zones. And then have this movie come out as though they were in a Hollywood studio somewhere. It was almost a slap in the face for what they'd done.
Yeah, she mentioned many times that it trivialized,
trivialized
their work.
That's the word, trivialized. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I talking to Scott O'Brien about his book about Kay Francis, one of the leading movie stars of the 30s, who has been a little bit forgotten, but we're doing our best to bring her back into the spotlight because such an interesting person. As I read your book and got a feel for her life. I thought, she's someone I'd like to know. And, you know, I certainly don't feel that way about Bette Davis or Claudette Colbert or Jean Harlow, but I'd like to just sit down and have a chat with her.
I'm sure she would with you, Rosemary.
Yeah. But, I mean, she seems so approachable, so personable, and she certainly had her ego under control.
She did. She did. And she had a great sense of humor, and she was interested in life. She was interested in the present and focused on that. That was pretty much her retirement years. She let go of being the film star. She was satisfied with having been an actress and enjoyed her godsons. And she retired in New York and spent time on Cape Cod in the summers and traveled.
She preferred not to live in mansions. Many of the places she lived were described as they were certainly comfortable, but I don't think she followed the trend of many of the leading stars.
Right. She was not impressed by the swank, and that's what she called it, the swank of Hollywood.
The swank.
She liked living simply.
Mm-hmm.
She considered her career as a business, as did William Powell, Jimmy Cagney. There was a lot of stars who weren't into having to have a certain part, or I mean, their life didn't begin and end with acting. Yet they were responsible. They took their roles seriously.
Yes, I was.
And she looked forward to saving her money and leaving it and going back to New York, where she felt more of an affinity.
I was impressed with her attitude toward it, that it was a business and not a calling. And some of her co-stars thought that was kind of cold of her. And some of them said that she was penny-pinching because she saved her money. But she was a good businesswoman.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
She made good investments and was taking care of herself, took care of her mother. And she's very generous. If she found out someone had been saving, like a wardrobe woman was saving for a car, Kay found out about it, she'd go out and buy her one.
Oh, my goodness. Such generosity. It's unusual, I think.
And on the set, one film that she found particularly challenging was The White Angel.
Oh, The White Angel.
Which was the story of Florence Nightingale.
Yes. Yes. I want to put off our discussion of White Angel just a bit, because I want to lead up to it with some of her earlier roles to give people a feel for the arc of her career. Because to me, it was an enormous change in the roles that she was playing. First, I want to read a paragraph from the foreword of the book by Robert Osborne, who's the host of Turner Classic Movies. And this is what he says. Of all the grand dames, glamour queens, divine divas, and fascinating females who dominated the golden age of cinema, Kay Francis was one of the most striking, most popular, and most fun to have around. Yet for too many unfathomable reasons, today she's one of the most forgotten and underrated of all these ladies. A wide patch of the population still knows Joan Crawford, Bette Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, Marlon Dietrich, and others who reigned mightily in films of the 1930s. But few are familiar with the elegant dark-haired lady who once outdrew them all at the box office. Before Bette Davis began her reign as the fourth Warner brother in 1936 in Jezebel, Kay Francis was the most important female star at the studio. Kay helped the Warner boys pay the mortgage for several years. And Robert Osborne goes on to say, at Warner's, there was a Kay Francis formula. With Kay, the fans were never satisfied unless A, she wore stunning gowns, B, she suffered in love. See, she did the right thing at fade out, even if it meant giving up the great love of her life, be it a husband, a swain, or a child. The public ate it up again and again, and it was her popularity with the public that ultimately seemed to doom her. As her hold on film fans grew stronger, so did her salary. And she was soon making far more money per week than any of her bosses. That's the end of the quote from Robert Osborne, the host of Turner Classic Movies. Let's talk a little bit about the studio system, which is what he's discussing here, that was responsible for her problems in making so much money that the bosses became uncomfortable with
her. Well, they were happy to get rid of her. because the films that she made in 1938 didn't bring in the money of the previous ones. Well, they were poor roles. Warner Brothers had purchased Dark Victory for her, which became a huge hit for Bette Davis. The Sisters was purchased for Kay and Miriam Hopkins, which went to Bette Davis. And the only role that Kay had requested was the Empress Carlotta, which became a huge hit in 1939 for Bette Davis in the film Juarez. It was a punishment. The fact that she had taken them to court was the salt in the wound. Here's their highest paid star taking them to court, which I felt she had a right to.
Certainly.
And then all these roles went to Bette.
Yeah. Was this before the Screen Actors Guild?
The Screen Actors Guild was founded, I believe, 1933-34.
Oh, so it was just brand new.
It became unionized in 1938-39.
Yeah. But why didn't she just go somewhere else and make movies if Warner's was treating her so badly?
Well, she was down in her cup, so to speak, after she left Warner Brothers. She did make a comeback In Name Only with Cary Grant.
But talk a little bit about how that contract system worked, that the movie stars practically belonged to the studio, didn't they?
They could be working in two or three films at the same time and arduous hours.
Yes.
Kay liked to be guaranteed 3 months off so she could go to Europe. She loved traveling. I think she went to Europe more than any other star at that time.
Uh-huh. And yet she was such a hard worker and made so many films. Yeah, let's talk about some of those early films. I want to read some titles to give you an idea of what she was doing. Here's some titles of some of the Kay Francis films in her early career: Marriage Playground, Dangerous Curves, Passion Flower, Scandal Sheet. And when you see the films, you know it's the clothes, her gorgeous satin gowns, all the men in tuxedos or white tie and tails, and jewels and tiaras, and they were countesses and counts and barons and titled people. It seems like fantasy was so important in those films.
Well, a lot of those films were adaptations from books, novels, and plays.
I see.
There is very little original material that came out of Hollywood, and she would point that out in interviews.
So that's just what people were writing in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it interesting that in times of economic trouble, quite often the popular books and movies are about extremely wealthy people and jewel thieves and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, that's where Escape to the Movies came from.
That's
it was
right.
Relief from, you know, the humdrum.
Yes. And in those days, it's very interesting the way that the films treat sex in those days. She made a movie called Virtuous Sin, then one called Notorious Affair. And here's a quote from Variety of those days. Kay Francis, whose upward rise has been very rapid since last summer, sufficiently supports, merely by her presence, the story's suggestion of a seductive countess of definite nymphomaniacal, or would it be nymphomaniacal, tendencies. That gives you some idea of what the movies were like before the code.
Oh, well, she was the best thing in that film.
Oh,
the star
was
Billy Dove, who was a silent film star.
Ah.
And she was quite mannered, coming from the silent school. Uh-huh. Kay didn't make any silent films.
Yes.
So she had a little bit of Broadway experience on Broadway. So when she came to Paramount, which was her first contract studio, that was from 29 to 32. She was at Paramount, did quite a number of films there.
Uh-huh. Was she happier at Paramount than she was at Warner Brothers?
I'd say she was happy at both studios.
Oh.
It's just that Warner Brothers offered a more lucrative contract, and they were going to build her up as a star.
Mm-hmm.
At Paramount, she caught people's eye, but she wasn't getting star parts.
Yep.
They weren't building films around her, and Warner Brothers, it was a big scandal in the industry. They got William Powell and Ruth Chatterton, who was a big name at the time, and Kay Francis. They grabbed them from Paramount, which wasn't exactly what the gentleman's agreement was at the time. But they acted on their promises and built up films around Kay.
And you're very thoughtful in including in your book what the critics had to say and about her films. And not only the critics, but other people who wrote about it. So we can get a feel for, as we read about each film, get the plot, find out who was in it, how it did at the box office. And then we can read what the reaction was of the public.
Well, right. I wanted to document... Well, basically, I wanted Kay's voice to carry the story. So I used a lot of excerpts from her interviews.
Oh, yes.
And then, focusing on what was the reaction by critics to these films at the time.
Yes. In her interview, she's quite outspoken.
Yeah, she didn't like to go too much into her personal life.
That's
but
right.
on other subjects, she was...
She was very open.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't feel that she was guarding every word or thinking carefully about what she said, that she was – they asked her a question and she answered it. Yeah. I found her very refreshing.
Yeah, she was probably a little irritated too because she didn't like to be interviewed on the set. She liked to concentrate on her role. So
yes,
that might have triggered these spontaneous reactions from her.
But wasn't that unusual for people to come right onto the set? And do they still do that today?
Well, I don't know anything about today.
Ah.
I'm living in the past.
Okay. Good for you.
I read that Norma Shearer welcomed. I mean, she was always on, you know, and no problem with Norma. Kay needed to concentrate. She wanted to concentrate. She wanted to stay in the mood.
Yes.
She couldn't turn on and off, maybe perhaps like a Shearer or a Crawford. Crawford loved her fans.
Yeah. Still in the days before the code, you say in one place in your book that such a storyline as in Notorious Affair wouldn't pass the censors a few years later.
Right. In 1933 and early 1934, the Catholic Legion of Decency clamped down on the film industry. They did several bans in, I believe it was Pennsylvania, Ohio. And the studio system thought, look at the power this church has. We can't afford not to listen to them. And so they created this production that there'd always been a production code, but now they needed to give the seal of purity to films, the PCA. And you'll see that on those old films,
yes,
that it had passed the censors.
It sounds like the kiss of death.
Yeah, it was sad.
Yes.
There was a lot of women who had any kind of independence, wanted to have a career, could no longer. And by the end of the film, they either if there was any infidelity on their part, they had to jump off a bridge, commit suicide, or crawl on their knees back to their man. It was there was all these rules set down by the. Basically, it was the Catholic Legion of Decency.
So the woman had to pay for her sins, and the man usually didn't.
Right.
Right. It's amazing the concept of the Legion of Decency completely changed film.
Right. Well, it reinforced the double standard.
Yes. Ah.
And...
Well, say a little more about that. There was a double standard then in operating before the Legion of Decency. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, I think the double standard that's always existed.
Of course.
Women do one thing, man can get away with another.
Right. Well, why would it be different in the movies, right?
And it started to loosen up. You started to get this feeling of liberation in the studio system from the early talkies and up to 1934. And then it was just clamped down. And then it was more challenging. They had to use a lot they had to be very clever to get some sophistication and innuendo into
the
screenplay.
The fire in the fireplace, the waves on the beach, that sort of thing, yeah. But I noticed that in 1932, when she made Trouble in Paradise, that her character was the president of a very important French cosmetics firm.
Right.
Now, was that
Collet and Company.
Collet and Company. That wasn't exactly realistic for those days, was it? Women weren't heading important corporations in 1932, were they? Or were they?
The subsequent book that I've done is on Virginia Bruce, and she played Knox, you know, Knox Gelatin. It was a woman who ran Knox Gelatin, and in the teens, she took it over. Her husband had passed away. She took it over, and she was the one who instigated vacation with pay, sick leave. Knox Gelatin was the first company, and then other corporations and companies followed her lead.
I had no idea. Now, this is your second book. Is it already out?
It'll be out September.
Tell us the name of it.
It's called Virginia Bruce, Under My Skin.
Virginia Bruce, Under My Skin. Right.
She was a blonde MGM star. She's the one who introduced the song, I've Got You Under My Skin.
No.
In the 1936 film Born to Dance.
Oh, my goodness. And then she went on to be a business executive.
No, she played
this oh, she
role
played
on
role.
Rodeo.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood. She played the role of the
of
head
Knox,
of Knox.
Right.
Oh, that's
I forget Mrs. Knox's first name.
But it's easy to confuse the stars with their roles because particularly, you know, when I think of Kay Francis, I tend to, you know, to see her as the character in the movies. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one must separate that, right? So let's talk a little bit about Kay Francis, the woman.
All right.
But first, let's take a short break.
Okay.
This is Rosemary Manchester. You're listening to A Novel Idea, and I'm talking with Scott O'Brien, whose most recent book is Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten. And we'll be right back.
They went to Hollywood. Would have gone to heaven if they could. But they went to Hollywood. They went to Hollywood. That's where the silver screen was done. The cream of the crop maker. Down in the high.
Imagine Miss Nightingale allowing any of her nurses to drink on duty.
No, she didn't allow it. It's the natural result of placing women in a false position. Under the circumstances...
Dr. Hunt.
Miss Nightingale. May I present Mr. Lefroy?
You do.
Will you kindly explain why you dismissed Sister Columba and put Miss Stevens in her place?
For the simple reason that the nurses refused to work under your Sister Columba.
They were working quite happily under her when I went away. But you let Ella Stevens and her nurses come out here, hoping that their incompetence would upset my work and give you a chance of condemning it.
Which only goes to prove what I've been saying to Mr. Lefroy. That women are unbalanced and therefore quite unsuited to be nurses.
If what I've done is to be judged by anyone, it will not be judged by you, but by the people of England.
That was a clip from the film The White Angel, which Kay Francis starred in as Florence Nightingale. It's quite different from the roles that we've been discussing, and in just a few minutes we'll be talking more about Kay Francis in The White Angel. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. In the studio is Scott O'Brien, the author of the new book, Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten. And we're talking about the movie star of the 30s, who is, I think, due for a comeback in as people learn more about the work that she did during her long career in films, on the stage, on the radio, and television. But right now we're going to talk a little bit more about Kay Francis, the woman, off stage and on. She was an athlete. She was a great tennis player, apparently, and loved sailing.
Right. She picked up sailing from her third and last marriage.
Yes, we'll talk about those marriages. Yes.
After that, she just stuck to it.
Yes.
And it was relaxing, and she became quite an expert.
Yeah, I had the impression they were quite good at it. They went back and forth to Catalina Island fairly routinely and spent a lot of time on the boat. Yeah, and then there's quite a bit in it about her fine tennis.
Right. She, of course, a lot of the stars played tennis, but Kay was considered one of the best. Charlie Chaplin, I know, challenged her in 1941, a couple of rounds. And she had what's amazing, she has these little tiny feet.
Oh.
I think a little triple A shoe.
Amazing.
And here she was able to. But when she was a girl in school, she was a fast runner, and
she was tall.
Mm-hmm.
I think for an actress,
5'7".
You know, someone had to stand on a box. Was that Charlie Chaplin or someone?
It was Edward G. Robinson.
Edward G. Robinson had to stand on a box.
In a film called I Loved a Woman, she played an opera star.
Ah,
and this was took place during, was it the Spanish-American War? And Edward G. Robinson was a meat packer. And he sent tainted meat to the troops.
Oh, dear.
So that was exposed. But he was very successful initially, and she went to him to get financing because she wanted to be an opera star.
I
and she
see.
More or less offered her support to him.
Oh, I see.
And he was married, of course. And at one point, he thought that she was being loyal to him, and she had numerous lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful scene where she says, well, it shouldn't make any difference. I still like you. And at the end of the film, this was, again, was a pre-code film. She
right.
wasn't executed or went to prison. The movie just went on.
Uh-huh. But in real life, she had ever so many lovers.
She did. And part of this was Kay grew up, basically, she was born in Oklahoma, but she spent most of her early years in New York. And she grew up with the sophisticated crowd. She had an early marriage at 17 to a wealthy Massachusetts heir,
mm-hmm.
Dwight Francis. That's where she got her last name.
Yes.
But anyway, by 1925, she was getting her first divorce. She went to Europe, and she was amid all the F. Scott Fitzgerald lost generation.
Mm-hmm.
She saw their lack of motivation. I mean, they were just mm-hmm. partying and drinking. She became part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that amazed me about her or helped me understand her, the flaming youth,
yes.
girls that were bobbing their hair, wearing yes. lipstick, smoking,
yes.
drinking, going to the speakeasies. These were signs of liberation at that time.
That's right.
So you have to put aside your own prejudices
That's
about
right.
those things and
mm-hmm.
say, hey, they were taking a step mm-hmm. forward.
Yes, they were breaking the rules.
Right.
Like doing what they wanted to do. And, of course, she looked marvelous in the clothes of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked great with her hair bobbed.
She did.
Yes.
Very striking.
And she's a stunning woman.
Some people thought she was a Maharani.
Oh. Well, I could see that.
No, mostly yeah. for just showing up at different, like at mm-hmm. Tony's Bar or whatever, all the hot spots.
Yeah.
But, you know, unfortunately, these habits of smoking and drinking, she carried with her through all the decades, and there was repercussions for that.
Yes.
But she was, again, that generation was looking at those things differently than we look at them today.
Yes. And the succession of husbands.
And lovers.
And, oh, of course.
She was a very passionate
yes.
woman.
Yes.
And now that I could almost understand. Oh, I could understand it.
Yes.
Not almost.
Yes.
Because I myself went to San Francisco State in the late 60s, early 70s, and we were exploring the same thing. It was just my big thing was letting my hair grow long,
yes.
and that was a symbol of my freedom. And we were exploring our sexuality and our
right.
passion, and that's exactly
right.
what she was doing.
That's
I have
right.
to hand it to her. Unfortunately, she was a very fertile woman,
yes.
and she had multiple abortions.
Oh, I know. It just broke your heart to read about those multiple abortions.
And the way I write about it is, okay, let's take take our focus off of Kay Francis and let's look at us. Let's look at our society.
Exactly.
Because contraception was illegal until 1938.
That's right. Isn't that incredible?
And guess what? That's when her abortion stopped.
Oh.
So how much, you know, where do you focus the responsibility
here?
Right. Maybe it's society and the individual.
But it makes you realize what a difference in our lives that contraception has made.
Right. And all the studios had clinics. Myrna Loy, Lana Turner, Jean Harlow. There were so many women who were having abortions at that time.
Incredible that they had to go through all that.
Yeah, it's sad.
It's extremely sad.
It wasn't happening in Europe. They had contraception in Europe way before it was legalized here in the United States.
Yes. I wonder if people of the new generation here are aware of how recently contraception became legal and available to women. It's been such a revolution that I think many young women think, well, haven't we always had the pill? No, we haven't.
Right.
Right.
Well, this was the diaphragm that was legalized in 1938. I had to do my research. I mean, I didn't know myself.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's that. When I said that the book is kind of a microcosm of American society, it was that kind of information that made me realize that she was a symbol of women of that generation, and I think an outstanding symbol because she was a survivor. The misfortunes in her life would have wrecked the life of a less strong woman, I think, but she just kept going.
Yeah, she kept on going, and I should add that I went to Wesleyan University and read her diaries. They weren't really diaries per se. It was engagement calendars, and she would write little notes, some of them in shorthand. They've translated a lot of them.
They're quite revealing. Yeah,
they are. And my partner was he had his computer there typing, and I was doing it by longhand, and he was saying, oh, my God. She's a nymphomaniac. I said, now, wait a minute.
Yes.
I said, you have to consider that maybe over a period of 10 years, she had maybe only 12, 14 lovers. That's not a lot.
That's right. That's not so many. And after all, she was very good to her mother.
Right. And she was young.
I mean, that's the other side of her.
She was in her 20s. Teens and 20s.
That's right. Yes. Is there quite a film archive at Wesleyan University?
There is. I forget exactly what other stars have their archives there. I was focusing on her, of course.
That was interesting.
Jeanine Basinger is head of the Film Institute there, and she's written a book called A Woman's View, which covers a lot of the things that we're talking about in terms of women's roles on film from 1930 up until 1960. It's another good book.
Can scholars go to the various archives?
I had to make an appointment. Yes. I had to make a reservation.
Yeah.
And it coincided with being able to visit her close friend, Jetty Ames and Lou Ames, who are in their 80s. Well, Lou's in his 90s now.
Are they still alive?
They're still alive. They invited us to Nantucket, and I got to see Kay's furniture. And, Jetty's still acting. She does a role in Nantucket each year and one in Tucson. We visited them twice in Tucson.
Wonderful. Explain to our audience who they are and the importance they had in Kay's later life.
Yeah, after Kay left Hollywood, she was a producer at Monogram, which is like a grade Z studio, but talk about an entrepreneur. She decided, this is a neat challenge. I'm going to produce and star in these three films. After that, she decided to go back on stage. The GIs had responded warmly to her shows that she did, and that gave her the courage to go back on stage. In the first production called Windy Hill, Jetty had a small part. She had taken over the part that Judy Holliday had done in this play.
Goodness.
And it wasn't exactly a great play, but it did standing room only wherever it went because people were coming to see Kay Francis, film star, on stage. So they became friends, Kay and Jetty. Jetty Preminger was her name at the time. She married Lou. Actually, they were married by that time. But the friendship stuck, and they had two boys. Kay encouraged Jetty, you know, if you're going to have children, do it now. You can always go back on stage.
Right.
And Jetty became a kindergarten teacher while her boys were growing up. And I talked to her godsons, and they had just wonderful stories to tell about Kay Francis in retirement.
Mm-hmm. It would be like having a wonderful aunt to have Kay Francis as one of the extended family members.
Right, right.
Yes.
With all her stories and, yeah, and glamour. So when I started doing the research, I found this article on Nantucket, Life on Nantucket, and Jetty Ames. And I thought, I'm going to try and locate her. So I got a phone number calling Tucson. She answered the phone. I said, this is Scudderby. And she said, why should I know you? And I said, I'm writing a book on Kay Francis. She says, now you have my attention.
And from, oh, my goodness.
And then from then on, it was just like we were old friends.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the hardest part, is contacting these people.
Yes, yes.
And it's like, I feel like it's almost an invasion of privacy, but you have to do it. That's,
well,
what, that's what makes the book come to life.
Of course, you want the story.
Contact, yes, any family members. They were really the only people who, yes, were close to her. She had no kin left.
Yeah.
And then some of the child stars that had worked with her.
Oh, yes.
And they were very generous with their time.
Yeah, those were lovely stories in the book, mm-hmm, about that. And the pictures of the child stars as,
right,
they were when the picture was made. It was interesting. Well, let's go to The White Angel.
Okay.
So after Kay made all these glamour films, then she made some B-movies, she made some Westerns. No, wait, did The White Angel come before?
They came before the Westerns.
Yeah, before
and
the Westerns.
B-movies.
Okay, I don't want to confuse people with my chronology. The chronology is all in the book, but Scott is,
right,
the one who knows.
Warner Brothers had had a great success with Paul Muni in The Life of Louis Pasteur.
Ah.
So they wanted to follow it with another biography.
That's,
they chose,
right,
Florence Nightingale. The problem was Florence Nightingale happened to be a woman. And she was a very different kind of a woman, a very revolutionary, a mover and a shaker, and didn't want anything to do with marriage. She had a meaty life. And, you know, I really don't think her story has been told on film yet.
Right.
I mean, she fought for example, health care for prostitutes.
Yes. She was ahead of her time.
She revolutionized what a nurse,
yeah,
was. Before that, nurses were prostitutes,
yes,
and usually alcoholics.
Yes.
And then she brought nursing into the military.
That's right. Everyone knows of her, mm-hmm, but I don't think we know enough about her.
Well, the script they came up with tried to make her into a saint. So Kay,
yes,
was up against that. She didn't know that when she signed for it. And,
oh,
then she got the script, and I think her diary said, got my script, oh my God. And the way it was filmed, they tried to make her saint-like.
Yes, right.
So she could get away with not being married, not being interested,
oh,
in men,
yes, right,
et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So that comes across in the film. But there are a number of scenes where she's allowed to show some of Nightingale's spunk. And,
oh, yes. But she had to fight for that, didn't she? I want to read to,
okay,
the listeners a paragraph that you wrote about. The offer to play Florence Nightingale was presented to Kay by Warner Brothers as an opportunity, albeit a double-edged one. Not only was she to effectively bring to life a historical legend, her efforts had to be reflected in impressive returns at the box office.
Right.
So she couldn't be too saintly, or could she? How did they position that for the box office?
Well, the film was released in the early summer of 1936. School had let out, and a lot of the promotions had dealt with schools. They didn't really know how to promote the film. And the climax of the film was to be her meeting with Queen Victoria.
Yes.
And then the British censors would not allow that. They said, you cannot show the Queen on the screen. So that took the punch out of the ending. And they had British experts there on the set who were interfering throughout. And again, some of the bite of Florence Nightingale's character was not allowed into the script.
Mm.
A lot of it had to do with the production code.
Oh, I see.
Limitations.
Yeah.
It really hampered.
Yeah.
It's an okay film,
mm-hmm,
but you have to have sympathy for Kay trying to make this thing work.
Yeah. Is that one of the films that's available, The White Angel?
No, it's not.
Oh, too bad.
When I started researching it, I got an email out of the blue from Paula Ferguson, who is a professor, PhD in nursing, asking me if I had the film. I said, I'd be happy to make you a copy as long as you answer all my questions about Florence Nightingale. So she happily did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a couple of months, they invited me to introduce the film at the Florida Nurses Association fundraiser in Daytona Beach. So that was another surprise.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah. It made the whole writing of the book a real adventure.
Oh, yeah.
I never knew what was going to happen next.
You have a very touching story in the book that took place during the filming of The White Angel, when one of the scenes, they filmed all day long in the pouring rain.
Right.
And there were a lot of extras, women who were playing the parts of extras. And at some point in the day, they were all soaking wet and they broke for a while. Mm-hmm. And they started taking care of Kay Francis and getting her dry and warm. And she said, wait a minute, what about these others?
Right.
He said, no, no, they're just extras. Mm-hmm. And she said, take care of them.
Right. Right. They brought Kay a heater and all these mm-hmm. Wraps and everything.
Yes.
And a lot of the women were elderly women mm-hmm.
yes.
because those were the ones who volunteered to go to the Crimean War.
Yes.
And Kay said, no, when you get them the same things you're giving me, then I'll be available to film the next scene.
Oh, people must have loved her, the people who worked with
right.
her.
Right. Well, they showed their gratitude. A group yes. of the women who were there knew that Kay wouldn't accept a big bouquet of flowers, so they took it to her mother. They found out where her mother lived, her mother who had been an actress in the early part of the century, and said, well, we know Kay wouldn't take these, but we want to give them to your mother.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah.
I really like Kay.
I think she'd be great to have over for dinner and hang out with.
Right. Is there anyone in the Hollywood stars today that you would feel was comparable to Kay in any way?
Well, I've thought about who could play Kay Francis,
right?
And the person who keeps coming up in my mind, even though she's a blonde, is Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, interesting.
Bright, intelligent.
Right. Yes,
has that subtle. She doesn't overplay.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's what attracted me to Kay Francis.
She has that wonderful face.
Place.
You
right.
can see the emotion in her face. Yeah.
And I think her face has a similarity to Kay's. You know, if you give her a dark,
she's beautiful,
dark hair.
And she's a very serious actress. Mm-hmm. What a great idea. Why don't you write the screenplay? I'll go see it.
Okay.
Yeah. Were those the good old days in Hollywood? Or are these the good old days?
Oh, I think there's a whole nostalgia, glow of nostalgia around the 30s and 40s. And when I've read interviews with people like Cesar Romero, I mean, they do have a lot of affection for those times, in spite of the limitations on their lives mm-hmm. and the surveillance of everything they did by the studios.
Yes.
Because there was a morals clause in all their contracts.
Yes.
And, of course, it became even worse after the production code.
Oh, yes.
I don't know. I think there's just those older films, there's a certain tempo and pace to them. I can relax and I can watch them. Nowadays, so many films are digitally enhanced and there's the scenes go by so fast and there's so much fast editing.
Yes.
It can be amazing to watch, but like they say, they don't make them like they used to.
Right. And with the old ones, you just kind of settle into it. And even if though the plot may be, you know, really silly,
mm-hmm.
but still you find yourself drawn in, especially in the black and white films.
Well, visually, they had these artists. I mean, the artists in lighting and editing and directing and the set designers and the costume designers.
Oh, yes.
And they built films around personalities. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of care and thought
mm-hmm.
that went into making these films. Mm-hmm. And the end result is, the stories can be silly, but there's so much else to absorb.
That's right. That's right. And visually, they're so so pleasing. I love the story about, you have it in as kind of a coda in the book, about the disposition of her estate, because she'd put together, you know, she saved her money. I was surprised at what she decided to do with the money.
Right,
tell us about that.
Yeah, well, she was a millionaire, and, you know, in the 1950s, that was quite a sizable amount of money.
Right.
Kay had a philosophy that being of service to others is the most important thing, and not just monetary, but your time. And she did spend hundreds of hours especially during the war, with people who were suffering. And she thought about the money that she had. The best thing she could do with it would be to donate it to helping the blind. So she donated her $1 million to the Seeing Eye, which trains guide dogs.
Yes.
And they were absolutely shocked. Now, she passed away in August 1968.
Oh.
And I contacted the seeing eye. Mm-hmm. And again, it was uncanny. They said, I can't believe you're contacting us, because this is like in the year 2004 I contacted them. Mm-hmm. We were just thinking, you know, we got this money in 1968. Actually, it was willed in 68. They finally got it in their hands in 71.
Yes.
And we wanted to do an article in our magazine on Kay Francis. We were just talking about it, and then we hear from you. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a small article.
Oh, that was nice.
To pay tribute to the legacy. Mm-hmm. And she said that it accounts for, I think, 70% the interest of the work they do today.
Amazing. What mm-hmm. a wonderful legacy. And the it's not exactly an irony, but you think that the blind people couldn't see the movies, but they're benefiting from the movies
right.
through her wonderful mm-hmm. generosity and underwriting the training of the seeing eye dogs.
And I have to add, Kay was a big dog lover.
Oh,
and I think that had something to do. She was amazed at what
well,
the
animals right.
could do.
Well, that's right. She always had a dog.
She always had a dog
with a cute name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell me, Scott, what's one of your favorite Kay Francis movies?
Well, one that I feel that was really significant for her, and she really did well with it, was a 1939 film. This is after she left Warner Brothers, and she made a great comeback. Everyone was shocked. She played a real mean-spirited, vindictive wife, the wife of Cary Grant. And I believe we have a little clip from it. This is a scene where Cary confronts her. He lets her know that he's aware that this was a marriage for money, not for love.
Okay, let's listen to that. Kay Francis and Cary Grant.
I want to talk to you.
It must be tonight, Alec. I have a splitting headache.
Sorry, but it must. Where'd you go?
I took your mother and father back to town.
I might have known you would. Ada, I've asked you several times for a divorce, and you've refused to give it to me. I'm not asking you now, I'm telling you. Either you get one or I will. I'm giving you the chance to do it the way that'll be easiest for you.
Funny. I was so sure. I thought I could keep you somehow. I didn't care how I did it. I never thought. And now I've lost.
Well, I must admit, I'd expected more of a...
More of a battle? Why? The battle's over. Now that it is over, I suppose I ought to wish you happiness. But I don't. I hope you will be miserable. I hope you'll both be miserable.
Yes, it's more like you.
No, I can't. I won't. I won't go to Reno. Oh, you'll get you the friends. No. No, I'll go to Paris.
But you can't avoid talk if you go abroad alone.
But I wouldn't have to. I could go with your father and mother. They're leaving on Labor Day.
They probably won't go when they hear about us.
But why do they have to know just now? Why couldn't I tell them when I get to Paris?
No, that's my job.
Oh, yes, I know, but... Oddly enough, they consider me rather a satisfactory daughter-in-law. I'd like to be the one to tell them that I haven't been.
All right. All right, if that's the way you want it. But understand, I don't intend to let anything into...
I'd like to be the one to tell them that I haven't been.
All right. All right, if that's the way you want it. But understand, I don't intend to let anything interfere with...
I'm selfish in a lot of ways, Alec. But even my worst enemy couldn't say that I'm stupid. I know when I'm beaten.
But what can you tell Mother and Father after what happened today?
I'll tell them that I had things out with you and that everything's fine again.
You know, Maida, in certain respects, I admire you a great deal.
You needn't bother. I'd do the same thing again if I thought I could win.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
Thank you.
So you've been listening to A Novel Idea, and Scott O'Brien and I have been talking about his book about Kay Francis. It's called Kay Francis, I Can't Wait to Be Forgotten. Now, surely there's a website, Scott.
Oh, there is, yes. You can go to www.kayfrancisbiography.com. That's KAYFRANCIS, biography.com.
Okay. Thank you so much. That way, I'm sure we've piqued the interest of a number of people, and now they have a place to go.
Right. It's available on Amazon and from the publisher.
Yes. It's full of wonderful stories, photographs of the of each of the movies she was in. It has a lot of information about her career and her life, a chronology of her 68 movies, and then the movie shorts and the radio plays and the television. And after you've read this book, you'll have a pretty good idea what a wonderful woman Kay Francis was. And I can see why you chose her to devote the years of research and writing. And you did a beautiful job.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. Yeah, I hope the listeners of A Novel Idea pick up the book.
I hope they pick up the book because they certainly will enjoy it.
And then the movies.
And yes.
Turner Classic Movies shows a lot of Kay's films.
Excellent. We'll watch for them. So thanks for coming in, and we'll be back next month with another novel idea. And remember, you can tune in every Wednesday night at 7 here at KRCB for a literary hour. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
I know a woman. She fell in love, and she married. Nothing unusual then in the marriage, until the husband began to have business difficulties. The closer he came to failure, the more he drank. Whether this was to make failure appear more or less important, I don't know. In any case, each step he took down, his head got proportionately larger. Finally, the husband's head got awfully big. Otherwise, he seemed to diminish. And during this nightmare, anxiously, with every ounce of her strength, she tried to bolster him up. She even went so far as to attempt to close an important business deal herself, with no other thought in mind than that of helping her husband. She met with some small success quickly. She hurried home to tell her husband the good news, certain that his hopes would be renewed, that he would be glad of an interval in which he could pull himself together. She confided her splendid news to him, that she'd saved his business career. She was all set to accept his gratitude, thanks, and affection. Instead of which, she was met with a volcanic explosion of injured masculine pride. At first, she thought the house was collapsing. It took her a full moment to understand that the awful thunderings were only those of her husband's collapsing vanity.